When a loved one is incarcerated, all the changes and all the emotions can feel overwhelming, mm-hmm. especially for children.
Yeah. When my dad went to jail, it was really hard. In, like, every way.
See, but always remember, Alex, you're not alone.
That's right. Kids need to know that there are people they can turn to. People who care for them and who will be there for them and help them through.
Yeah, like us.
Right.
Yeah, it really does help to know you're not alone.
Alex, a character on Sesame Street, says, "All this talk about my dad and where he is makes me upset. My dad's in jail. I don't like to talk about it." What effect does a parent's incarceration have on children? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. My guest this hour is a nationally and internationally recognized scholar on children with incarcerated parents. She served as an advisor to Sesame Street on its Emmy-nominated initiative for children with incarcerated parents. She has studied brain development in children, and in particular, the effect of parental incarceration and other forms of trauma on childhood development. Joining me is Julie Pailman, the Dorothy A. O'Brien Professor of Human Ecology and Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the UW-Madison. Welcome to University of the Year.
Thanks so much for having me, Emily.
I'm always fascinated by what brings someone to a particular field, the niche that they have at the university. Do you have a particular passion for children that are suffering from trauma or a particular interest in incarceration and its effect that brought you to this place in your career?
Yes, actually, I'm trained as a child clinical psychologist, and after I earned my PhD, I was working as a clinician in upstate New York, and it was at a clinic that served a 5-county region, and I started getting a lot of referrals of children, very young children, whose mothers were incarcerated. And because I was trained as a scientist practitioner, I thought, oh, well, how can I best serve these children and families? And so I went to the scientific literature, and what I found is there wasn't a single study that had directly assessed children with incarcerated parents at that time. It was in the 1990s. And I thought, wow, if I go back into academics, this is something that's incredibly needed because the U.S. had, you know, been in a period of mass incarceration, and we knew that the number of children affected was growing. We just didn't know anything about it. And so then I ended up coming to UW-Madison, and that was the first grant application that I wrote when I was here. It was to study young children with incarcerated moms, and it went from there.
Why do you think there hadn't been very many studies or any studies that you saw of the effect of incarceration on the children?
I think that they were often invisible. When people think about people who are incarcerated in a prison or a jail, they often are not thinking of the family, and certainly not thinking that, oh, that incarcerated individual has children. And we found that through the government's national surveys of incarcerated individuals that half or more than half of incarcerated individuals are parents to minor children. And so if you think of the millions of people who've been incarcerated during this period of mass incarceration and in the past several decades, that means millions and millions of children are affected. And so part of my job has been since the 1990s is to really raise awareness about how many kids are affected and how they are affected by a parent's incarceration.
I would think it would be a difficult thing to study objectively because there's so many variables in terms of who gets locked up and what are the environmental factors before that incarceration takes place. But we know that even, you know, here in Wisconsin, we've got a terrible record when it comes to disproportionately locking up families of color, you know, parents of color, for example. And so you've got issues of race, issues of poverty. If you have someone who can't afford an expensive lawyer or afford the bail, many different factors that play a role in who winds up in prison. When you set out to study this, how did you come up with a way to apply science to the sort of messy nature of human existence itself with so many variables?
It has been a tricky problem, and I think that when sociologists started studying children with incarcerated parents, they came up with some novel ways of creating kind of match groups to account for what they call selection effects, meaning that they're pre-existing things that might create a propensity for a certain individual to become or be incarcerated. And so looking at large data sets, they've been able to tease out some of that because it really is, you know, in our country, not considered ethical to randomly assign people to being incarcerated or not incarcerated. This actually has been done in other countries because they have different kinds of laws and they're randomly assigning people to like an ankle bracelet or community service or something like that. But in the United States, we don't do that. And so you have to find creative ways of accounting for those selection factors. And so over and over now, we're finding that when you account for all those factors, like you mentioned, like poverty and even the experience of trauma and other kinds of things, we do find that there is an effect of parental arrest and incarceration on children's development in a host of different areas.
Well, maybe let's start with just some statistics, if you have them, on how many children do you think right now in the United States have had a parent in jail or prison?
We don't have super accurate statistics because most systems still do not track those numbers. So, for example, average departments of corrections in different states don't include parental status in their intake. And schools as well, like in public health systems where they're interacting with kids, often don't ask if a parent is incarcerated. And even in the foster care system in many states, most states probably now, they only record parental incarceration if it's the immediate reason for placing a child. They typically have not asked if that has occurred prior to their placement. So the statistics we have are from some nationally representative studies, and we think that they're probably underestimates. So, for example, we know that about 1 in 14 U.S. children have experienced the incarceration of a co-resident parent prior to the time that the child turns 14 years old. And that's a co-resident parent, meaning they were living together. And so it doesn't even count the children who have a non-resident parent who may still very well be helping with their care, providing income to the family, interacting with the child. That those statistics don't even include those kids. But we also know that Black children are like 5 times more likely to experience the incarceration of a parent than white children. So it's incredibly disproportionate in the general population.
That's a staggering statistic that it's that high. And it's interesting that nobody kind of routinely finds that out as part of any school document or Department of Corrections document. So you mentioned children who have parents who were arrested. In your studies, I saw one where it looked at, in some cases, children witnessed the arrest or witnessed the crime, in addition to just the trauma from having a parent incarcerated. What did you find when it came to the trauma of being privy to the arrest itself, the crime itself, and the difference that made on the impact on a child?
The study you're referring to focused on children who were aged 2 to 6 years old, and they did have a parent who was in jail at the time that we assessed them. And we asked the incarcerated parent and the child's at-home caregiver if the child had been present or witnessed the parent's arrest. And then we asked how distressed the child was. And then we also collected a number of measures. And one innovative measure that we collected was looking at children's stress levels through analyzing their scalp hair. So we, with permission, of course, trimmed off a little piece of the kid's scalp hair, which is about equivalent to like 1 to 3 months of accumulated stress hormones. And we examined the stress hormones cortisol and cortisone. And then we also looked at how the children had been doing regarding their symptoms of stress over the past several months. So we could have some idea of, well, where some kids are already stressed out, because we know that children with incarcerated parents experience about 5 times the number of adverse child experiences as children who have not experienced parental incarceration. So we know there's potential for other traumas. So we looked at that. And what we found in general is that the children who had witnessed their parents' arrests prior to their incarceration had higher stress hormones in general. But when they were already stressed out because of a number of different factors and they witnessed the parents' arrest, they exhibited what's called a blunted stress reaction. And this is really concerning, because what happens is when a child is extremely or chronically stressed out, what happens is their stress response system ends up on really high alert for a long period of time. So usually when people are stressed, you know, people get stressed every single day and it's part of normal existence. And we experience things like our pupils dilate, we might get a dry mouth, we might get sweaty palms, our heart races. We're kind of activated to, you know, the traditional is flight or fight. And our systems get activated. And then when the stressor passes, we calm down again. Our heart rate slows. Our body can focus on other things like digestion or, you know, normal cognitive processing. And we calm down. But in cases, especially when very young children are stressed chronically and repeatedly, what happens is that they experience such intense and prolonged stress reactions that their body no longer produces normal stress hormones in any really measurable amount. And that can really affect both the function and the structure of their brain development. It's considered to be really the kind of response that one sees in people who have post-traumatic stress disorder. So that was very concerning in the study. And it does need replication, because it's really the first study where anyone even measured stress levels in young children whose parents are incarcerated. And we are really concerned about what it means, though, for their development.
So are you saying that if you have a child that has prolonged exposure to stress, in a sense they become kind of, I don't know if numb is the right word, but the fact that they have less of the cortisol, less of the stress hormone, is a bad sign? You know, that it's better to keep producing it and having sort of an immediate response than to have it happen so much that it – like, why is it a bad thing if we stop producing the
stress? Right. It means we can't have a normal stress response, so that if anything happens that would require us to be, you know, responsive to stress, the physiology of the body doesn't respond in the normal way. And then that affects brain development. And so it means that the children are not equipped to be able to like react to stressors or then calm down once the stressor has passed. They get really easily dysregulated. And sometimes it can affect their learning and other aspects of their development. And we did another study with a different sample in children age 3 to 8. And what we found is that the children in that study who witnessed the parent's arrest prior to the parent being incarcerated in jail had less optimal health. They had lower developmental milestones, especially in the areas of learning. And so even though we didn't measure stress hormones in those kids, we suspect that we're seeing those behavioral effects of being so stressed out for so long and having that witnessing the parents' arrest as like a real trauma that it's hard to get over. It's hard to cope with that.
And how does that compare to children who suffer separation from parents for other reasons, such as the parent becoming ill or dying or, you know, in a case of an absent parent who just leaves the home, is the specifics of the arrest and the incarceration different in terms of the impact on a child?
It's a great question, and there have been no direct comparisons looking at stress in kids who experience those different kind of separations. But there was a study coming out of the UK more than a decade ago that looked at boys in London who had experienced different kinds of separations from their parents, and they found that the kids who had experienced parental incarceration were kind of the worst off. And one of the reasons that we suspect that being separated from a parent because of incarceration as opposed to other things like military service, illness, death, etc., is there's a lot of things that happen in families where there's a parent's incarcerated that don't happen in these other kinds of separations. And one of those things is the forcible removal of the parent through the arrest that kids in 20 to 50% of cases are likely to witness, but also things like the stigma associated mm-hmm. with having a parent who's incarcerated. It's really hard for kids and families to cope with that because in our society there really is so much stigma and negative view, not just of the incarcerated individuals, but also the entire family. And we've done studies where the kids have reported being bullied because of that. We've also done a line of research looking at what children are told about their parents' incarceration, because many families want to protect kids from that stigma. And so they might do what my colleague Avon Hart Johnson, who runs DC Project Connect in Washington, D.C., she calls that compassionate deception, meaning that a family makes up a story about where the child is just to be kind and try to protect the child. But unfortunately, in the long run, that kind of compassionate deception often doesn't work because the child often learns from other people. They overhear something or they hear from someone in the family outside of the family where the parent really is, and then it can undermine trust in the child's caregivers or their parents. And so I know you played that clip from Sesame Street. One of the things that we recommended in those materials, which was based on research, was talking to children in a simple, honest, developmentally appropriate way about parental incarceration and not going into too much detail. Don't want to traumatize kids with any scary details, but to just reassure them that the parent's okay. They didn't just, abandon the child. And then also to help the child process their feelings of loss and confusion and help them know that it's not their fault.
I would think one additional factor that makes it hard for children to cope with the incarceration is that if you have an adult who has committed a violation of law, you have to explain that to a child. You know, your dad is in prison because he broke a rule or, did something wrong. It seems that that would be shattering to that sense a child has that they can look up to the parent as their role model.
It can be hard for kids to take that. And I think it can make them question. But I think that one of the messages that we like to give kids is that people can do something wrong but still be good people. They can still love you. You can still love them. And I think that's one of the things that Sesame Street did really beautifully, actually, is to explain how you can be like your parent in some ways and not in other ways. And you can always have other adults you can turn to as well with a lot of, a kid's big feelings. And so I think it's really important to kind of separate that out. But we have done studies looking at how people talk to children about the parents' incarceration. And we actually did a pretty rigorous evaluation of the Sesame Street materials, and we found that the families who received those messages in the materials, that they were much more likely to report feeling comfortable talking to children about the parents' incarceration, and that they felt like it increased open communication in their families. And then we also have just a brand new study that we're just got the results from, showing that when children had watched those materials, they were more likely to feel positively about their families, which I think is a really great thing.
I want to talk to you more about your relationship with Sesame Street, which reaches so many millions of families all over the world, when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Hey, Alex, maybe we can get our dads to make cars like that with us. Huh?
Oh, yeah. And then we can race cars together.
That's a great idea.
I don't think so.
Oh, come on. It would be fun.
Yeah, just ask your daddy.
Well, he can't do it.
Well, why not?
He's not around right now.
Huh? Well, where is he?
Somewhere else.
Oh, did he go on vacation?
Is he visiting someone?
Yeah, where'd he go?
Yeah, where?
Look, I don't want to talk about it. Okay?
Okay, yeah. Did we say something wrong?
I don't know.
He's upset about something. Come on.
Okay, Alex! Alex, are you okay?
You seem kind of sad. Mm-hmm.
Listen, Alex, whatever it is that's on your mind, you don't have to tell us. But we're your friends, and you can always talk to us if you want.
It's just all this talk about my dad and where he is got me really upset.
Oh, because your daddy's away?
And you miss him?
Yeah, but because of where he is, too. My dad's in jail.
In jail?
Why?
I don't like to talk about it. Most people don't understand.
Actually, I do understand what you're going through. When I was about your age, my dad was incarcerated, too.
He was?
Wait, what's carcerated? And why was your dad in it?
Incarcerated is when someone breaks the law, a grown-up rule, and then they have to go to jail or prison.
That's from a Sesame Street program about incarceration of parents. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Professor Julie Pailman, and we were talking about children with incarcerated parents. Julie, tell me about your role working with Sesame Street. I think they've always been so much in the forefront of all kinds of social issues, whether it's race or divorce or, you know, all kinds of subjects that other programs don't talk about. How did you get involved in creating the materials for children with incarcerated parents?
In 2009, I received an email from the head of one of Sesame Workshop's programs, and I have to admit, at first I thought it was kind of a joke, but it was real. And I responded, and they told me that they were doing a new resilience initiative because, as you mentioned, they do try to stay on top of, you know, the heartbeat of what's happening in different areas. They're all over the world, and they do different initiatives in different countries to based on what are the social issues in those countries. So, for example, in their work in South Africa, they developed an HIV-positive Muppet to help, you know, kids cope with that issue. And in Palestine, they've developed Muppets who talk about things like, you know, war or terrorism, etc. And so in the U.S., because of the decades of mass incarceration that have been happening, they were starting to do a new initiative focused on resilience, and parental incarceration was one of the issues that they were tackling. They've also tackled parental substance abuse, different kinds of trauma, natural disasters, bullying, lots of other issues, homelessness, autism. There's so many wonderful initiatives that they've been working on. And what happened is that they had done some work with the Department of Defense a while ago, focusing on kids who experienced a parent in the military and that separation when they went on active duty. And then also it expanded to when a military parent was hurt or even killed. And so they worked on issues related to parent-child separation and grief, et cetera. And at the time, the Department of Defense came to Sesame Workshop, apparently, and said, look, we have a lot of vets returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, and a number of them are ending up incarcerated. And we wonder if you have the capacity to develop any materials about that. And so Sesame Workshop looked up the information, realized that it wasn't just about vets returning. It was this incredible thing that had been happening to the United States because of changes in policy that had occurred over, you know, decades, and that we had been in this period of mass incarceration for a long time, and that many, many young children were affected. And because I had already published about young children whose parents were incarcerated, they invited me, along with a number of other people working in, as advocates and in the nonprofit arena, to be advisors for them on this initiative. And so we met. I presented my research. We helped write the curriculum. We were there for the taping of it. We were able to, you know, give our input. And then, as I mentioned, my team actually got a grant to evaluate the materials. And so materials came out in 2013, and then we launched a randomized controlled trial to examine how the materials related to when children were visiting their incarcerated parents, and then also how it helped caregivers talk to kids, and how if it helped children feel any differently about the incarcerated parents or their families. So I've been working on that since 2013, and have been really pleased with where that the educational materials have gone. So originally they came out in hard copy, multimedia materials. There's videos, there's a children's book, there's a caregiver guide. And we did deep dissemination of those materials in 10 states, including Wisconsin and Minnesota. And then, as I mentioned, we did our randomized controlled trial. So now they don't have the materials available in hard copy, but they're available free online and in the App Store.
And I assume that they also, some of the videos would have played on the sort of regular Sesame Street programming, or were they kept as a separate kind of separate packet of materials only for children with incarcerated parents?
Yeah, they were kept separately as a standalone package for kids with incarcerated parents. Some of the characters they develop for their special initiatives do end up on the show, and other ones don't. So it really just depends. And so far, they haven't introduced Alex into the regular show. But the materials are, you know, really popular and used. And they're available in both English and Spanish. And so they've been used across the United States, and I know internationally as well.
I think they should be on the regular program too, because I just watched a few of the clips, and you've got them linked on your website and other places, and they're really moving. And I think it's not just for the child going through it, but for anyone around that child who might not know how it feels, you know, might not be thinking about what it's like. It seems to me it promoted a real sense of empathy and understanding.
I agree, and I think that's true of a number of their initiatives that haven't made it onto the TV show. But I do know, just anecdotally, I haven't systematically studied it, but I do know there are some kindergarten teachers, preschool teachers that they show a series of Sesame Street videos, including the one about parental incarceration, including the one about homelessness, bullying, etc. And they just have it open it up for discussion among the kids. And oftentimes there are kids that, you know, self-disclose what they've been going through, and it allows the other kids in the class to be supportive and understand. And so I've heard some really positive anecdotal feedback, which can help just normalize what we can talk about, and it can help decrease stigma and help give kids words to be sensitive and supportive to other kids and help with that message. One of the key messages in the materials are, you are not alone. There are still people who care about you and love you. And I think it really helps with that message, the more kids and families and teachers who watch the videos.
We've been mostly talking about fathers who are incarcerated, and I'm sure that's the big majority. But there's with mothers that are incarcerated, I ran across this on the Vera Institute of Justice webpage. It says over 5 million children in the United States have experienced the incarceration of a parent. For children whose mothers are currently in jail or prison, Mother's Day is likely to be marked by absence, powerlessness, and pain. Many of the women who will spend this Mother's Day in jail, traumatically separated from their children, have not even been proven guilty of the crimes of which they're accused. They simply lack money to purchase their freedom pretrial by paying bail.
Yes, indeed. Those are true sentiments. People who are in jail are often there before they are convicted and before they're sentenced. So about 60% of people in jail are there for pretrial. And then there have been a growing number of women, the vast majority of whom are mothers, incarcerated. So in some jails, they make up about 15 to even 20% of the population. And another thing to keep in mind is that when we talk about parental incarceration, oftentimes people think prison. And yes, it is a problem. And if you look at the daily population of who's incarcerated, more than a million are in prison. But if you look at those statistics over a year's time, between 8 and 10 million admissions to jails occur across our country each year. And that is a huge number. So actually, most incarceration occurs in jails. And as I mentioned, 60% are there prior to conviction or prior to sentencing. And that can really, you know, affect children because there's a lot of uncertainty around that. And it's hard to cope when a loss is so uncertain or ambiguous. And so many children are affected. And there's also some differences in kind of what happens when a mom is incarcerated versus a dad. So, for example, when a mom is incarcerated, the mom is way more likely to have been the child's primary caregiver. And so when the mom is incarcerated, most of the kids end up with a family member that's not their other parent. So like a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle or an older sibling. And then children with incarcerated moms are 5 times more likely to end up in foster care than children with incarcerated fathers. In 90-some percent of the cases, when a dad is in jail or prison, the mom is the one who cares for the child. So when a mom is incarcerated, it just means that a child often has to go through a lot of changes and have you know, disruptions in where they live, where they go to school, what's their neighborhood, who they're living with, etc. So it's you know, can be particularly problematic.
You had mentioned before that some parents or relatives choose a kind of compassionate deception where they don't tell a child where the incarceration, you know, where the parent is, that they're in jail or prison, you know, create a story instead. I'm wondering about the difference between telling a child your parent's in jail because they broke a law or did something bad versus telling that child your parent is in jail but they shouldn't be. It's a wrongful case because we know that there are innocent people who are in jail or prison either, you know, and they haven't even been tried yet, or they're put there, you know, mistakenly. And I'm just curious about the, you know, how parents handle that situation, because, you know, there's all these cases where somebody is found to be innocent 20 years later and they proclaim their innocence all along, or where something that is a minor thing escalates and becomes something they're imprisoned for, especially if they are from communities of color. So is the injustice that's in the criminal justice system itself, does that play a role in how children respond?
I'm sure it does. There hasn't been any systematic research on that right now, but certainly if a family knows that it's a wrongful accusation, a wrongful conviction, that is something they can talk with children about. And then really it's never too early to talk with children about race. And certainly because of huge racial and economic disparities in the criminal legal system, you know, for example, who is stopped, who is actually arrested, who is convicted, who is incarcerated, how long they're incarcerated for. We know that there are disparities at all of these different levels, and it's absolutely important to talk with children about that. And right now, the research isn't to the point where we've been able to make a lot of those fine distinctions, but I do think it's worthy of future study and definitely worthy of family conversations about. And I've talked to families in which, you know, the parent who's incarcerated is adamant that this was wrong, or that they're in jail because, you know, when there's a cash bail system, they might not be able to afford getting out. And then also the way that the system is working right now kind of puts people at a disadvantage, because in 95% of cases, the incarceration is determined based on a plea deal. And that means that sometimes people agree to plead guilty to a crime, even if they didn't commit it, just so they can have a shorter time incarcerated. And they're often not given very much information, and they have a very short time to think about it. And so they might sign something indicating that they plea to be, you know, mm-hmm. to being guilty so they can have a shorter sentence. And that, as children get older, certainly you can talk to them about that. But in the case of much of the research I do, it's with very young children who might not understand all of those nuances. They mostly just need reassurance and a brief explanation of where the parent is, and that the parent's okay and still loves them. And as they get older, they certainly will have more questions and more detail can be discussed with them. And I think it's just incredibly important to keep that on the radar of, you know, people who work with the kids and families and also researchers.
I had one student in my UW Odyssey project who was born in prison because his mother died in childbirth, giving birth to him in prison. And then he went in and out of prison himself before really finding education and a new sense of purpose. He now ministers to men behind bars. But, you know, this idea that you could be born in prison and come into the world already caught in this cycle of poverty, of sadness and anxiety, and then the criminal justice system, I would think the impact would be there from whether you're looking at a newborn all the way up to teens or adult children for that matter. But you've mostly focused on the sort of developing the toddlers, preschoolers age.
Yes, that's a very tragic story. And I do have colleagues like Rebecca Schlafer at the University of Minnesota who does a doula project for pregnant incarcerated women to ensure that the women give birth in a way that they're not completely alone. Because the typical scenario, what happens is if a woman's giving birth and she's incarcerated, she is only allowed to have a guard with her. And in many states, shackling a woman in labor mm-hmm. and the birth process is still allowed. It's not in Minnesota, but in Wisconsin, there was legislation that attempted to go through and it was never passed. So it's still on the books that that's a possibility here and in many other states. And then typically what happens is that when a baby's born to an incarcerated mom, the mom has to find care for that child within 24 hours or the child will go into foster care. And so I don't know what happened to the young man who was born in prison and his mom died, but it's possible, you know, he might have had to go to foster care unless he had family members who are willing to step in and care for him as a newborn. But it is true that the carceral system has a very long shadow. I know that there was a recent book by Reuben Miller where he talks about his dad's involvement in the criminal justice system and his brother's, and that it's something that's like always with him, you know, that it's been present in his life kind of forever, and he thinks it will be, and it can have like a pretty long impact. And then even though my research focuses on really young kids, I collaborate with other people who focus on older kids. So, for example, I recently did a study with Elizabeth Johnson at University of Tennessee and Beth Planop at UW-Madison focusing on 9 to 10-year-olds whose parents had been arrested. And we found that the children had more behavioral issues and less optimal executive functioning than other kids, even controlling for a whole host of demographic factors. And that was with a nationally representative sample was part of the Adolescent Brain and Cognitive Development Study. And then I've collaborated with Kristen Turney at UC Irvine to look at we did a review of the studies looking at the impact of incarceration on child development from you know, birth outcomes all the way up to young adulthood. And so, you know, I think that what was striking in that review is that the negative outcomes were vast and that they were more pronounced when the incarceration occurred when children were very young. And then also the outcomes seemed to get worse as children got older. And that really suggests that there's some underlying process that's magnifying those effects as children get older, such as one of the things that I talked about before, which is children's stress systems and how if their stress systems are overwhelmed, it can affect their long-term development.
I want to talk about visits, children visiting parents in prison, and also ideas that you might have about solutions, changes that would make this less of a horror story, when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
This is my favorite picture of me and my daddy. He used to take me to the park all the time. But he can't right now, because my daddy's in prison. Today we're going to visit him. Me and my mom and my little brother Michael are going to take a bus. On the way, Mom reminds us about the rules at this prison. We can talk to Daddy and see him, but we're not allowed to touch him. I just can't wait to see him already. The walls are tall at the prison, with lots of gates and wires everywhere. I hold Mom's hand a little tighter as we walk in, and she lets me know it's okay. Sometimes, we have to wait online a long time before we can see my daddy. We pass through loud gates that open and close behind us. Then we go into another room where we have to wait again. Finally, my daddy comes in. His hair is a little longer than last time. It's good to see him. At first, I forget everything I want to tell him. But then we start talking and it gets easier. Daddy says how proud he is of us for helping Mom at home and for all the things we're learning. It's hard not to be able to touch or hug each other, but Daddy blows me a kiss. I tell him I'll save it for later. Before we know it, it's time to go already. I don't want to say goodbye. I wish Daddy could come with us, but this is where he has to be because he broke a law. But we all look forward to the next time we can come and visit again. As we take the bus back home, I think about Daddy going back to what he does in prison. And I know he'll be thinking about me, just like I'm thinking about him.
That's from the Sesame Street Initiative for Children with Incarcerated Parents. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Julie Pailman. Julie, you've done some work on visits, whether they're effective or harmful. Can you talk about that, whether it is a good thing when children visit parents that are incarcerated or how to handle those visits?
Absolutely. So more than a decade ago, I started talking with a number of people who were working in the field, and I was really surprised by how strongly people felt about children either visiting or not visiting. And some people said, oh, you know, visits can re-traumatize a child. It can be really negative because of, you know, the security they have to go through, seeing razor wire, seeing their parent, especially if it was behind glass or behind bars. And it's maybe related to something we call secondary prisonization, meaning that the family actually experiences some of the negatives about the carceral system, even during a visit. And then on the other hand, there were people saying, oh, children should visit. And they would work to get a court order that even if the child was two and they lived across the country from the corrections facility, that a stranger could just pluck them up, fly them across the country, and they could have a visit with their incarcerated parent. And I thought, okay, what does the literature say on this? And there weren't any studies looking at how children did with visits. And so I decided to take that up as one of the things that I study. And so I've done a series of studies looking at visiting in, you know, between children and their incarcerated parents. And so one of the early things we found is that a lot of it depends on, like, how the visit happens. So, for example, in most jails across our country, and you'll remember that's where most incarceration occurs, visits occur either behind, like, plexiglass or, you know, glass. So people can't touch the parent, and they can only hear them through, like, an old-fashioned telephone line or through video. So they, again, can't touch them, and they see them on video. And whereas most prisons had in-person visits where there could be contact, even if it was limited, they could still hug at the beginning and end and hold hands. And that there were also some, although it was rare, what we call child-friendly visits. And that's when there were these special times where kids could interact with their incarcerated individuals in a little bit more normal way. So there were developmentally appropriate activities or snacks, and there was unlimited physical contact, so they could hold hands, and the kid could sit on their parents' lap, and they could read books together, and they had some freedom of movement, and it wasn't a typical visit. So what we started finding is that the plexiglass visits were particularly tough for young kids. They didn't understand why they couldn't touch their parent. They spent a lot of time watching other people's visits. They oftentimes melted down, laid on the ground, cried, and it was worse the longer they waited for the visit. And then we also found that child-friendly visits seemed to be so superior, that the kids were supported. It was a positive experience. They were prepared. They felt really good about it. So then I've also started doing some evaluations of programs, and then created with a team of people here at UW-Madison an enhanced visit program. And so, we've been learning a lot, and we certainly know that a lot of how frequency of visits relates to child behavior and child well-being has to do with how the visit happens and the quality of the visits, which, you know, we've tried to quantify, but it's challenging because it's really in-depth work. And with the coronavirus pandemic, it's really changed the whole scene of visiting.
And just the way in the clip the family went on a bus to get there, the distance that a parent is placed away from where the child lives makes it very challenging for those at the poverty level who don't have transportation. So that's another factor. With this topic of children with incarcerated parents, which is such a heart-wrenching, difficult, disturbing topic to think about, what gives you hope? I mean, you work on this, you study it. you know, you have to quantify it and all that. But I'm sure there are times when you must feel the pain of what you're studying. And I'm just curious what gives you hope.
There is a lot of suffering and pain and stigma and loss. But many, many children and families are doing things that create resilience processes, meaning that they are helping children do well despite the significant adversity that they're experiencing. So they support children. They talk to children in a positive way. They help children get involved in programs, whether it's a mentoring program, a program at the Boys and Girls Club, a supportive visiting program, whatever it is, there are ways. And one of the things that we've found is that it's actually, even though children with incarcerated parents are about twice as likely to experience challenges and problems than other kids, controlling for a whole host of factors, we find that most of the kids end up doing well at, you know, in one or more areas of development, which is really positive. And I think that it's just a testament to how much support there is in their families, extended families, in their neighborhoods, in their schools, and in the community. But still more could be done. There still are a number of kids that are, you know, falling through the cracks, so to speak, and need an additional amount of support.
Well, thank you for your work in bringing to light this sort of invisible group, the sort of collateral damage of incarceration, the children.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to listen to Sesame Street, You're Not Alone, another clip as we go out. But my guest has been Julie Pailman. We've been talking about children with incarcerated parents. I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
Many children have, many are like you. You're not alone. I'm by your side. My ears are here to listen. My arms are open wide. You are not alone. We are here for you. We will be your friend. We'll help you through.
You're not alone. Look around.
Like me.